From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
A boost for clean energy, but what's the ultimate cost? Hello again, I'm Armin Almy, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The Obama administration has approved America's first offshore wind farm in shallow waters near Cape Cod in Massachusetts. For the past 9 years, such projects have become common in Europe, while Cape Wind has been subject to high-powered opposition and heated debate. What are the economic trade-offs? What are the consequences for fishing, tourism, historic preservation, and tribal rights for Native Americans? Is this the birth of a new alternative energy industry? What will it mean for the Great Lakes and other parts of the Atlantic seaboard? On Reporter's Notebook, later on, the U.S. Supreme Court and the separation of church and state. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. After 9 years of debate that's divided politicians, environmentalists, and local residents, the Obama administration has approved America's first offshore wind farm in the waters near Cape Cod. Supporters hail a new green industry. Opponents say the cost is destruction of a national treasure, Nantucket Sound. On Reporter's Notebook, a commemorative cross stands on federal land in California's Mojave Desert. Is it a government endorsement of religion? We'll hear about the U.S. Supreme Court's first church and state decision since John Roberts became Chief Justice. First, this news update. The massive oil slick in the Gulf of Mexico is now 600 miles in circumference and growing fast. It's a consequence of last week's blowout and fire on the Deepwater Horizon drilling rig. The latest plan to keep it from washing ashore is burning it off. Brett Clanton reports for the Houston Chronicle. And Brett, thanks a lot for being on our program.
You're welcome.
Do we know if burning has actually begun?
Well, the latest is the Coast Guard said that they were planned to begin burning pockets within the big slick 11 a.m. Central Time. But we haven't gotten confirmation. I checked with them a little bit ago, and they said they couldn't confirm if it had actually begun. So we're all sort of staying tuned right now for the moment.
Okay, now mid-afternoon in Texas. What parts of the slick are the most susceptible to being burned off? I understand there's clumpy oil, there's a sheen. Are they really quite different?
Yeah, and it's, you know, if you think about this, you know, the entire surface area of this, as you mentioned, you know, an area 600 miles in circumference, there are pockets within that where the oil has kind of grown a lot thicker, and so they're really targeted in these areas. They're going to try to get boats out there and drag boom and corral these heavier pockets and then light those afire, because those pose the most direct threat to the coastal areas if they wash ashore. The rest is this kind of rainbow sheen they talk about that can't be lit. They've compared it to, like, if gasoline fell on the ground at a service station while you were pumping, you would see a sheen there, but it wouldn't necessarily be uniform across there.
Are they pretty much reconciled to the fact that some oil is going to go ashore?
I think that's the consensus now. I think now the effort is trying to minimize the damage from whatever washes ashore. That sheen, if that comes to shore, from the way the experts describe it, if you were on the beach, you would still smell it. You would still you might even, you know, see some evidence of it, but it's not nearly what you would think of. Like the tarry stuff that everyone still has in their mind from, like, the Exxon Valdez. So that's what they're trying to attack first, are those clumpy, emulsified pockets of oil within this entire slick, which they estimate is about 3% of the total slick.
Back to the burn. What about air pollution?
Well, that's a trade-off that the Coast Guard, you know, acknowledged yesterday. Clearly this is, you're going to consume some of the oil at the surface and hopefully, you know, mitigate some of the impact on the coastal areas. But, this is going to be, you know, huge plumes of smoke. I don't think it's going to be like the Icelandic volcano eruption, but it may not be that far off.
That's a grim prospect. How close will that be to shore? Is there a possibility of health problems as a result?
Well, I think this is where weather conditions are really a big factor. You know, they talk about today the conditions being favorable out there with northwest winds, winds from the northwest, which, if you can imagine, would send the smoke out into the Gulf. So I think that's the only kind of circumstances under which they would they'd go forward.
Meantime, of course, there's a lot leaking up from the bottom, 42,000 gallons. That's about 1,000 barrels per day of crude oil. How are they doing in terms of capping the well?
Well, there's, you know, they're still trying to close off these valves that are sitting on top of the wellhead. There's a big, huge piece of equipment there called a blowout preventer. It's 50 feet tall and 450 tons, and it's sitting right on top of the wellhead. And they're still trying to use these robot submarines to close off the valves, but they've been trying for days and still unsuccessful there. So they're moving ahead, you know, at the same time with some of these alternate remedies, but those could take weeks and, you know, even under the worst case scenario, months.
In the meantime, which states are expected to be hit the hardest? What sorts of preparations are they making?
Well, it looks like that, you know, Louisiana, like eastern Louisiana, and from there on, you know, over to Florida are sort of in the main zone of impact, if you will. You know, the Coast Guard says that they've been working real closely with state governments in, you know, each of those states to, you know, to mobilize different cleanup crews and put out containment boom and things like that. But, you know, Coast Guard has been sort of reassuring that they've got it under control. But you know, it's still anyone's guess what that's going to look like if it comes to shore.
Okay. There's not just tourism, of course, but wildlife, fishing, both sport and commercial. Pretty grim situation there now in the Gulf. Brett Clanton with the Houston Chronicle, many thanks for being on our program.
You're welcome.
In a moment, a boost for clean energy, but what's the ultimate cost? On which way? On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. The Obama Interior Department has approved Cape Wind, America's first offshore wind energy project in shallow waters, 6 miles from Cape Cod, 10 miles from Martha's Vineyard in Nantucket Sound. Cape Wind now has the federal go-ahead to build 130 wind turbines, 440 feet tall, in 25 square miles of ocean. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar made the announcement today in Boston.
Cape Wind will be the United States' first offshore wind farm, supplying clean power to homes and businesses in Massachusetts while creating good jobs here in America. This will be the first of many projects up and down the Atlantic coast, which I expect will come online in the years ahead as we build a new energy future for our country.
Again, Ken Salazar, the Secretary of Interior. Sean Cochran is senior reporter at WCAI on Cape Cod. He blogs at the Cape Cod and Islands. Right now, he's in Hyannisport for local reaction to approval of Cape Wind. Sean, good to have you on our program.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
This has been wildly controversial for 9 years. How are people on the Cape itself who are going to be looking at this, presumably in days to come, reacting to it now?
It depends on where they stood. There are certainly, I found people who were very happy, and then other people, when I told them the news, they looked like I just told them someone had died. Then there's the third group, which is the ambivalent group, people who, despite all the time that has passed, have just been unable to come to a decision about how they feel about putting something so large in Nantucket Sound.
How visible is it going to be from the shore?
We can look at simulations, and but it's hard to know exactly from photo simulations what's accurate, what isn't, who's put together the simulation. I know when I sailed out into the middle of Nantucket Sound with Secretary Salazar back in February, certainly the coast was very visible. Houses were visible, though small. They're 440 feet tall, bigger than the Statue of Liberty, about 5 miles away. So you can see them. You'll be able to see them.
What about the shoals themselves? How shallow is the water there?
Well, you've hit on something. That's one of the reasons this private developer selected this section of water here off the coast of Massachusetts. in places during certain times of the day, you can stand on these shoals. I've seen pictures of folks with water up to their knees standing on these sandy shoals. So that's one of the reasons the developer likes this site.
One of the complaints has been that there might have been native burial grounds on that site in the past. What's the status of that situation right now?
Yes, this area of Nantucket Sound once was dry, and we know that to be a fact because one of the things the developer had to do was borings to go down into the sand and see what they found, and they found evidence of forest. And so the Wampanoag tribes say, we walked on those lands, and we probably interred our dead there, but we haven't found any evidence of interred Native Americans there quite yet. So that is a major concern to them. What Secretary Salazar did say today is that he's going to require additional borings, additional archaeological research.
What about the waters in terms of fishing? If they're that shallow, do a lot of boats actually pass over that area?
It's certain areas that are more shallow than others. Certainly, fishers do use that area. We saw fishing boats out in that area, draggers, when we were with Secretary Salazar in the distance. Exactly who goes where, it's hard to say, but they are dragging significant lines behind them. So even if they're dragging perhaps a mile or half a mile away from where the array of turbines would be, it's not like they can just stop and turn on a dime. So the fishermen in the area have been pretty upset by this, as have the different ferry boats that travel between Cape Cod and the islands of Martha's Vineyard in Nantucket.
You're in Hyannis Port. That's where the Kennedy family compound is located. How important to this dispute was the late Senator Edward Kennedy and the rest of his family, for that matter?
It's a great question. For a long time, we didn't hear much from Senator Kennedy. Occasionally, we'd get a sound bite when someone put a microphone in front of him, but it seemed like he was operating mostly behind the scenes down in Washington. And there were some examples of some legislation that it looked like had been inserted to kind of stop the project involving Senator Kennedy and some of his allies in the Senate. Those were exposed in the media and did not seem to work. We can assume that Senator Kennedy played a large role in delaying this project. But at the same time, there's significant research that had to be done because the United States government had never even considered an offshore wind farm before.
All right, Sean Cochran, again in Hyannis Port, and I just want to go back to the very beginning of our conversation. There seems to be a considerable ambivalence even in Hyannis Port, which will be obviously very close to the wind farm if and when it's ultimately built.
Some people just don't know how they feel about it. They love the sound so much, but they're torn by the idea of green renewable energy. Even the hardest environmentalists around have had trouble deciding just which way to go on this one.
Sean Cochran, again, senior reporter, WCAI on Cape Cod, blogger at The Cape and Islands. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Beth Daly is an environmental reporter for the Boston Globe. She was at the news conference where Secretary Salazar announced this decision. And, Beth, thank you very much for being on our program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
One would think that maybe 9 years of debate would be over, but there are going to be some lawsuits filed, are there not?
Yeah, you would think. One thing about the Cape Wind Project you do learn is that it really never ends, and it's not going to. I mean, certainly today was a very big decision. It's one people have been waiting for literally 9 years. But now the lawsuits come. Audra Parker, the president of the Alliance to Protect Nantucket Sound, the main opposition group, pledged to file a lawsuit. In fact, they already filed a notice of intent to lawsuit. She said she may be going to court as early as tomorrow looking for an injunction to stop construction of the project, which its developers say could be started up in the next year. So, yeah, the lawsuits are going to come. But we've been talking to a lot of legal experts today, and it's been actually quite interesting. They don't feel the opponents have a lot to stand on, in part because of the really long permitting saga. And that's because it seems that the federal government has dotted every I and crossed every T in dealing with this project. I don't know if that's true, but several legal experts we talked to indicated that they would be surprised if a federal court issued an injunction. either for the Native Americans who are opposed to the project or people who just don't like the aesthetics of it.
It's interesting how this breaks down politically. We have Senator Scott Brown, the Republican who replaced Ted Kennedy, saying this is a misguided decision. He's very opposed to it. We have John Kerry, the Democrat, saying that now that the decision has been made, he supports it.
Yeah, it is. I mean, this is, you know, the one thing that's been great about this story, if you're watching it from afar, is the political maneuverings. I mean, the late Ted Kennedy became somewhat infamous for his efforts to stop the project. And now it looks like there's a new generation of political fights going to go on. It's totally uncharted territory. Scott Brown made very clear today that he was not in favor of this project. I don't know how far he'll go to try to kill it, and he certainly doesn't have the clout that Kennedy did, but I'm sure he'll try. Kerry, meanwhile, who's been really in a tough position throughout this whole time. I mean, he was a mentee of Senator Kennedy. He a lot of his support is on the Cape and the Islands, and he's walked a very delicate line to a lot of criticism, I may add. But he came out and said really what he's been saying all along, which is, look, I'm in favor of the process. If the process goes through and this is approved, then I'm for it. And that's exactly what he said today. He said this process was exhaustive. He was convinced that, you know, as I said earlier, every I and every T had been crossed, and he was seeing this as jobs for Massachusetts, clean energy jobs that we've been trying so hard to get here. So I doubt the politics are by any means over, but for now they seem sort of everyone's taking a deep breath and figuring out what comes next.
They're saying that they may be able to generate energy as soon as 2013 and that the energy will go to Cape Cod, to Nantucket, Martha's Vineyard, the islands offshore there. Do we know at this point, Beth Daly, what the cost of that energy is going to be?
Okay, so this is really interesting. First, if energy doesn't go to Cape Cod and the island, it's going to provide the equivalent of about three-quarters of the, at least according to the developers, three-quarters of the power that the Cape and Islands use annually. It's going to go into the grid. So basically, it'll go everywhere,
sure,
right? They don't
sure
distinguish that. But that's actually kind of important because it's been a... But the second thing is it's going to be more expensive. We don't know the cost at all. National Grid is still in negotiations with Cape Wind for a power purchase agreement. But one thing will be clear. It will be more expensive. I mean, renewable energy, particularly offshore energy, is more expensive than conventional energy. It's why it's been so hard to get it built, in part. But what you've seen in some states, in Rhode Island, for example, in Massachusetts, I mean, there are a group of people, I'm not saying there's a lot of them, but there's certainly a significant group of people who are willing to pay a premium for green energy in hopes of starting a sort of revolution of clean energy. They're the upfront buyers of it in hopes that the price, you know, as more and more projects come online, the prices will become lower and more competitive with traditional coal and gas. And the scalability will be such that you'll have, you know, competitive pricing. And I think that does exist in Massachusetts, certainly. People are very environmentally conscious here. Will it exist to the point that it will help the nation's, you know, sort of realize its clean energy goals? I don't know. But it will be expensive to start off and probably for some time.
Beth Daly, environmental reporter for the Boston Globe. Thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thanks for having me.
One of those very much opposed to this, and presumably that's still the case, Beth Daly just said that the argument never ends, is Cliff Carroll, founder of windstop.org. He's been fighting the Cape Wind project for 9 years. Many of his stakeholders are fishermen and others local to Cape Cod. Cliff Carroll, thank you very much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for taking your time.
What's your response to what has happened? Do you think this is over or not?
It's absolutely not over. In fact, it's far from over. In fact, the real battle will now begin. One of the problems that's been going on with this process, despite all these claims of crossing T's and dotting I's, is the fact that the federal government has basically ignored all of the objections of the local stakeholders. We still have an FAA determined hazard issued on the project, which is unresolved. You have the issue with the civil and cultural rights of the Wampanoag Indians, which is now being ignored by the federal government. We've never had the issue of their 40,000-gallon oil transformer platform and damage it would wreak on our economy and marine habitat evaluated. And in addition to that, after 9 years of this project making all types of claims, we have never been told what this electricity is going to cost the ratepayers of the Cape and Islands. It's just an absolute outrage. I think that Secretary Salazar and Governor Patrick and President Obama should be ashamed of themselves for this decision.
What's the Transformer platform? I hadn't heard about that before.
No, it's probably one of the best kept secrets. In the middle of this project, just off our pristine beaches, they're going to be putting a 100 foot tall, 200 foot wide, 40,000 gallon electric transformer platform, which contains 40,000 gallons of dielectric transformer oil. We all see what's going on down in Texas. Everybody's worried about an oil spill hitting there. Cape Wind's own oil spill report states that in the event that that transformer ruptures, that oil can hit our shorelines in as little as 4.8 hours. The U.S. Coast Guard has actually already told the president of Massachusetts Fishermen's Partnership that they will no longer be able to fish Horseshoe Shoals, which is some of the richest fishing grounds in the area. I heard Sean Corcoran earlier referring to people standing on Horseshoe Shoal. There's about a 20-foot section of sand that you can do that. The rest of the shoal itself is anywhere from 8 to 40 to 50 feet deep, which is another reason why there is absolutely no reason this project couldn't have gone to the alternative site on the backside of Nantucket. It's just an absolute outrage. The local Steamship Authority, Highline, the local airports have all filed formal complaints with the FAA, the U.S. Coast Guard, all of which have been ignored. The state's own Massachusetts Historic Officer and the federal government's own historic panel said that this was an area of historic significance and deserved protection. This is just a bad decision being made for the feel-good purpose of providing wind, and the people of Cape Cod are sick over it.
Tell us about the alternative site, quickly as you can.
The alternative site is a site which is located on the backside of Tuckanuck Island, which is just off of Nantucket. It's on the outside of Horseshoe Shoals, where you would eliminate the conflicts with the ferry lines, the conflicts with the airports, the 400,000 flights a year that will travel through this airspace, the dangers of the oil transformer platform releasing inside of the Nantucket Sound, which is essentially a small ocean lake. And in addition to that, it's a steadier wind, which is offshore. But it also, most importantly, takes it outside of the ancient Indian burial grounds and the cultural aspect that will affect forever the religious rites of the Wampanoag Indians in both Mashpee and Aquinnah.
Cliff Carroll, again, the founder of WindStop.org, Fighting the Cape Wind Project. This project, as was indicated earlier by Beth Daly, has divided environmentalists. In a moment, we will hear from the National Resources Defense Council, which is in favor of Cape Wind. Stay with us, though, Cliff Carroll. We want to hear you interact with our guest from the Natural Resources Defense Council. On Reporter's Notebook later, the first decision on the separation of church and state since John Roberts became Chief Justice. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warman Olney back with To the Point, talking today about Cape Wind after 9 years of debate approved today by the Department of the Interior of the Obama administration. Massive towers about 6 miles from Cape Cod, 10 miles from Martha's Vineyard in Nantucket Sound. We've heard how big they are, the potential risks to fishing, to birds, to the FAA and air traffic. Now we've also heard about a transformer platform, 100 feet tall, 200 feet wide, presumably with transformer oil that might come ashore, according to Cape Wind itself, in 4.8 hours if there's a leak. And there is an alternative, according to what we just heard from Cliff Carroll, founder of WindStop.org. Nonetheless, the Natural Resources Defense Council has been supportive of Cape Wind. Nathaniel Green is the Director of Renewable Energy Policy for the NRDC, and thank you very much for being on our program.
Thanks for having me.
How come you're in favor of it, given all that we just heard from Cliff Carroll?
Well, I mean, we've been involved in this process since it started in 2001 and watched the environmental review process, and for a long time we waited to see the results from that process. And we based our conclusions on our review of the Army Corps' draft environmental impact statement, and then the second draft environmental impact statement from the Mineral Management Service, and then the final environmental impact statement from MMS. And when we looked at that and we talked to our colleagues and experts in the rest of the environmental community, including Mass Audubon, we reached the conclusion that the benefits from this project, which are intrinsic in the technology, lower air pollution, lower water pollution, lower greenhouse gas pollution, outweighed the potential risks of environmental impacts, which are important, and it's critical that we take the mitigation steps that the Department of Interior has required, but we can't afford to keep waiting to get the benefits.
Given what we've seen the last few days in the Gulf of Mexico, what do you say about this transformer platform that Cliff Carroll talked about earlier?
Well, I think it's important to keep the scale of impact here in mind. In the Gulf of Mexico, the rig down there is leaking thousands of gallons of oil an hour. So 40,000 gallons of oil is not trivial, but it's much, much smaller. And I think the Secretary Salazar put it well, which is, our addiction to fossil fuels has put us in a place where we suffer the impacts of fossil fuels all the time. And if we can't find places and really make commitments to a clean energy future, we will continue to suffer those impacts. So this is a concrete step, shows we can do it. We can do it now. We can move forward.
What about the alternative site outside Tuckanuck Island?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that both the developer who's actually doing the engineering and understanding the economics and the Department of Interior rejected the alternative site. So I hope we can get more projects and more sites developed, but I don't think this is a valid alternative.
What about the concerns for the historic nature of Horseshoe Shoals and its value to the Indian tribes there? The National Park Service apparently split with the Mineral Management Service, both in the Interior Department, and said this ought to be preserved, untouched.
Well, I, first off, NRDC absolutely respects the traditions and religious practices and history of the First Nation across the country, especially in Cape Cod. Our role is to assess the environmental impacts, and I think the process, the opponents say they ignore issues, but the process has reviewed these issues and taken steps to mitigate them and decided the balance. And from an environmental perspective, we agree that the balance, the benefits, the guaranteed benefits outweigh the risks of the potential impacts.
Cliff Carroll, back to you with the founder of windstop.org. We heard earlier that a lot of people in your area, we heard from Hyannis Port, are in fact ambivalent about this and feel that the arguments we just heard from Nathaniel Green and others are very persuasive. What chance do you really think you have of stopping this project?
About 100%. What will happen essentially is all of the items have been ignored and all the science has been put aside. It's just basically been a science versus politics process through the Army Corps, through Minerals Management, and now through the process that Secretary Salazar just allegedly attempted. What will happen here is once this enters into a court of law where the true rules of evidence apply, and then they are not allowed to ignore the science. They are not allowed to ignore issues such as radar interference, oil spills, what this is going to do to the seabed here. They're going to be dredging over 130 miles of cable through our clam flats, through our Nantucket Sound itself is one of the richest squid breeding grounds in the entire world. All of these issues have been completely ignored, and they will not be able to continue ignoring them once we are in a court of law where the rules of evidence apply and where you are not allowed to completely sideline the real issues in the interest, again, of building a feel-good project. Cape Wind will not be America's first offshore wind farm. The project down in Delaware will be up and running long before we're into the courts on this.
Again, Nathaniel Green, back to you with the NRDC. You've been in court arguing against the Army Corps of Engineers, against the Mineral Management Service more often than you've been on their side. What do you say to the legal possibilities here?
Well, you know, we'll have to see who files what suits, but you know, the process, the environmental impact review process, and the environmental impact statements is a critical part of our the way we strike balances when we look at development across the country. This project's taken dramatically longer than the typical coal plant has, and the review, in our opinion, has been dramatically more exhaustive. And again, I would just take issue with the idea that they've ignored these issues that are being raised here. It's not that they've ignored them. They've looked at them and they've decided that those impacts can be mitigated, minimized, or simply don't outweigh the benefits that we're going to get. So, you know, I think it's unfortunate that we'll have to wait while the opponents continue to try to obstruct this project, but that is part of the review process that's critical for you know, trying to minimize environmental impact. So we'll see what the courts decide.
Well, thank you both for being on our program. Nathaniel Green, again, Director of Renewable Energy Policy at the Natural Resources Defense Council, and Cliff Carroll, the founder of windstop.org, for and against the project off Cape Cod. Let's talk more in general terms about what this means for the wind energy industry. Tom Vinson is Director of Federal Regulatory Affairs for the American Wind Energy Association. And Tom Vinson, thank you very much for being on our program.
Thank you.
Rather than continuing to debate the situation on Cape Cod, let me ask you a couple of questions. First of all, Cliff Carroll just mentioned a project in Delaware. If, in fact, the Cape Cod project is held back, is there any chance that Delaware could get online first?
You know, your guess is as good as mine about which project is going to be first. I mean, besides Delaware, there's three projects in New Jersey. You know, there's two projects in Rhode Island. There's one off the coast of Texas. There's some Great Lakes projects under consideration by a couple of states. So, you know, which one of those is going to get to the finish line first is anybody's guess.
How important, though, is this decision today in terms of wind energy and the effort to get it underway?
It's very significant in terms of the offshore industry because it signals that the federal government is serious about growing this industry here at home. You know, Europe is far, far ahead of us in terms of offshore development. They have several thousand megawatts in the water already, with several thousand more under development. China's first offshore wind project is going to go into operation later this year. So, you know, we're coming up behind other countries who are already taking the lead on this. And the other issue related to not just the clean energy that these other countries are getting, but they're getting the economic development associated with that clean energy. We've seen announcements from major turbine manufacturers that they're going to site new facilities in the UK in order specifically to serve that offshore wind market. And we need to bring some of that manufacturing here as well. But in order to do that, we have to have a signal from the federal government that they're serious about deploying offshore wind here, and today's announcement is the first of those important signals.
Just quickly, given that Scott Brown, one of the senators from Massachusetts, is Republican, of course, who replaced Ted Kennedy, is against this project, is there any threat at all from your standpoint that there might be some change in federal law that would impact this, or do you think that the wind industry and potential investors will regard this as a green light?
Well, as you heard from your earlier discussion, I mean, there's potential lawsuits and whatnot, too. But I think, you know, the decision today is a significant one, and I think the investment community will look at it as such. You know, I don't want to speculate on what may or may not happen legislatively going forward. You know, but the interior ruling is sort of the final federal say on this, and we'll see what happens going forward. But, you know, the signal to the investment community is clearly that the federal government, the Obama administration, are behind and supportive of deploying clean offshore energy.
Tom Vinson, a Director of Federal Regulatory Affairs for the American Wind Energy Association. Sam Jaffe has been listening patiently to our conversation. He is in Seoul, South Korea at the moment, very kindly agreed to participate today. He's a renewable energy analyst for the IDC Energy Insights, which is a market research and consulting firm. And Sam Jaffe, thank you very much for being on our program.
Thank you.
Let's talk a bit about economics here. What about the cost of offshore wind energy as opposed to onshore wind energy?
The rule of thumb is that offshore wind energy is approximately twice as expensive as onshore wind in terms of putting the towers up and getting the project going. And that's a factor of, number one, it is more difficult to work in that environment. You have to, you're far from land. You're sinking these towers into the under the seabed, and that's simply more expensive and more challenging than doing it on terrestrial ground. And secondly, there's the factor of the conditions that represent a threat to the equipment out there. So the operations and maintenance of that equipment, because of the salty air, because of the frequent winds, because of the just severe conditions that you experience out in the sea, make operations and maintenance more expensive. However, there's another factor, which is simply we don't have good experience building offshore, especially here in North America, because we haven't done it yet. And anytime you do something new, it's going to be more expensive as you learn your way around it. And as Tom mentioned, Europe has a pretty good head start. China is aggressively pursuing offshore wind also. They're learning, they're gaining that expertise in putting these sticks in the ground or in the water, so to speak. And therefore, they're quickly going down that price curve. So I would expect, as we build more projects, that 2-to-1 price differential will decrease, but it will always be a little bit more expensive to put wind offshore.
Back to Tom Vinson with the American Wind Energy Association. What are some of the advantages of offshore wind as opposed to onshore wind?
In general, the winds offshore are steadier, so you'll get higher capacity factor, meaning the projects will generate more consistently. Obviously, the turbines are going to be closer to load, just being off the coast, so you've got less of a need for long-distance transmission. So, in terms of the cost differential that you were just talking about, Cape Wind itself doesn't have a PPA, a power purchase agreement, yet, so we don't know what the cost for sure is going to be. But the other, a couple of the other projects that do have PPAs have varied widely. The Delaware project that was mentioned was around 10 cents a kilowatt hour, which is it's certainly not 2-to-1 compared to onshore wind. And one of the Rhode Island projects was over 20 cents, so that is more in the 2-to-1 or higher range. So I think at this point we don't know for sure what the cost factor is going to be. But even with respect to Cape Wind, as you may have seen, that some economic analysis that was done recently showed that on the whole, consumers are going to be better off because it's going to be displacing over the long term more volatile fossil fuel prices.
Sam Jaffe, again, you deal with renewable energy of all kinds. What about other alternatives, solar, for example, in terms of cost and availability here in this country, particularly given the higher costs of offshore wind? Are there alternatives that would be a lot cheaper?
Not necessarily. And the reason why is what Tom referred to, which is the closeness to the load. So 80% of the United States population is near a large body of water, either the oceans or the Great Lakes. And if you have and you have a lot of wind in those areas also. So you have an ideal situation of siting the generation next to or near the load. Now, if we were to build out more, which we are doing, but if we were to do it even faster, to build out more in the Great Plains, for instance, in the Dakotas, in Texas, and then string transmission lines all the way to the East Coast, the cost of those transmission lines would be nearly prohibitive. So you're balancing this the cost of cheaper onshore wind plus expensive transmission, or more expensive offshore wind plus much cheaper transmission.
Don't you also lose a lot of energy in the transmission lines?
Yes, you will definitely lose electricity in the transmission lines, and that's part of the cost of doing. And the longer you go on those transmission lines, the more energy you will lose. So that's also part of the cost of going down that path.
What about solar? Is that simply out of the question in areas near the coast?
It's not out of the question. It's certainly more advantageous in southern areas where there's more sunlight, more solar insolation. However, New Jersey, for instance, is heavily subsidizing solar photovoltaics today, and that program is ramping up in a big way. But solar is much more expensive today. Hopefully the prices will come down, and we see certainly a path for them to come down in the next 5 to 10 years. But right now, that solar is not competitive with either onshore or offshore wind.
There's a lot of tax subsidy involved here, and Cape Wind certainly will get tax subsidies. Is there any chance, Sam Jaffe, that or will that how will that affect the cost to consumers and taxpayers all around the country?
The tax subsidy is the same offshore and onshore. So, in my understanding, Cape Wind is not receiving any favorable federal tax subsidies above what an onshore wind farm would get, and it's in the form of a production tax credit, which is an extra few cents per kilowatt hour that's paid for by the taxpayers, essentially, and it is it's compared to the subsidies in Europe and some of the subsidies in Asia, it's a relatively small subsidy. It's not an enormous cost to the federal government. And it's understood by the industry and by the government that eventually that subsidy will disappear, will be phased out, and that it won't, at some point it will not be needed anymore. It's essentially meant to spur the growth of the industry.
And Sam Jaffe, once again, a final question to you, as briefly as you can answer, because we're running short of time. Do you think that if Secretary Salazar had not approved Cape Wind today, that would have been a sort of death knell for investors in offshore wind projects in the United States?
It would have been a severe negative, but I don't think it's a death knell. It would have been a death knell. I think that offshore wind is going to happen. It makes too much sense not to happen, and it's just a matter of perseverance on the part of the developers to get some projects developed. But I think that the fact that it was passed and that it was approved by the Interior Department is certainly a very positive step for the offshore wind industry.
Tom Vinson, a final question to you, again, with the American Wind Energy Association. What about consumers here? We don't know what the price, and you indicated this yourself, is going to be of electricity that comes from Cape Wind or any of the other projects, for that matter. How do you know that it's going to be affordable and not just so expensive that it has a deleterious effect on the economy?
Well, as I mentioned, you know, the range of pricing we've seen for the offshore projects in the U.S. so far has varied pretty widely, but some of them have been not that much above the onshore wind. And I think, as was mentioned earlier, you know, the pricing in Europe is subsidized pretty heavily, but that hasn't been a major impact to consumers over there. And, you know, it's also compared to what? You know, we don't know where fossil fuel prices are going to go over the long term. We've seen the price of oil and gas vary widely over the last couple of years. And so there's a value to locking in a set price for something over a 20-year period. And so I think, you know, at the end of the day, the consumers are going to be better off from that.
Well, thank you both very much for being with us. Tom Vinson, again, Director of Federal Regulatory Affairs for the American Wind Energy Association, and Sam Jaffe, Renewable Energy Analyst for IDC Energy Insights, again speaking to us from Seoul, South Korea, in the wee hours there. Thank you both again for being on our program, and thanks to our other guests as well. Since 1934, a cross honoring World War I soldiers has stood on federally owned land in California's Mojave Desert. For years, it's been tied up in litigation over the issue of separating church and state. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court settled the question in another 5-4 split decision, as we'll hear in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
We're only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. A lower federal court ruled that the National Park Service should remove the old cross from public land because it amounted to a government endorsement of religion. Today's Supreme Court decision says that is going too far. David Savage covers the court for the Los Angeles Times. David, good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren.
Before we get to today's ruling, a little bit of history. Who cares enough about this cross out in the Mojave Desert to take it to court?
Well, the ACLU of Southern California, for one, they have there was a former Park Service official named Frank Buono who had sued, said he was offended that the cross had a he was originally bothered that the cross was given sort of special treatment. There was some group that wanted a Buddhist symbol, and the Park Service said no. And so he joined this lawsuit, but it's basically been carried on by the ACLU of Southern California, which has taken a consistent policy of saying that religious symbols should not be on public or government land, that they are amount to the government endorsing religion. So it was the ACLU's case, really.
Okay. What did the court decide?
Well, it was a messy sort of 5-4 decision. I actually think what the court said is more important than what they decided in this case. Justice Kennedy is now the majority person on this. Till 5 years ago, it was Sandra O'Connor. And her view had always been that if a religious symbol sort of can be seen as an endorsement of religion, the Ten Commandments on a public square, a manger scene at the Christmas season, if that can be seen as an endorsement of religion by the government, it's unconstitutional. Kennedy has never agreed with those O'Connor opinions, and he spoke for the majority today basically saying, oh, a religious symbol has a lot of other meanings. For example, he said in this case, a cross is a symbol to honor the war dead. It's not just a Christian symbol. It's a symbol to honor the war dead, and therefore the judges made a mistake to sort of focus on the religious aspect of it. He said they should have essentially upheld it because it was honoring war dead. And I think the same thing will come up in the future involving the Ten Commandments. Every time the Ten Commandments are challenged, the public officials say, well, the Ten Commandments are part of our nation's history, our heritage, our moral, cultural heritage, and they should be upheld on that grounds. They're not explicitly religious. So the short of it is, I think Kennedy's opinion today in this case will have a broad effect down the road in other cases involving church-state displays.
What did the dissenters say?
John Stevens spoke for the dissenters and basically said this is a a cross is a Christian symbol. It's a sectarian symbol. And, yes, we should honor the war dead, but we shouldn't do it with an explicitly religious symbol on public land.
So the argument then is over what the cross means.
Correct. Yes. The majority says the cross has meanings beyond religion, and we ought to look to those other meanings. The dissenters say we ought to look to the fact that it's a religious symbol, and that should be the reason why it shouldn't be on public land.
How big is this cross compared, for example, to the crosses we see at veterans' cemeteries all over the country?
It's very small. I think it's about 10 feet. It's way out in the Mojave. You'd really have to go out of your way in Southern California to ever see this cross. I think that was one of the points that was sort of brought up in this. This is not like a big cross along I-5, down to San Diego. It's a very small cross. But I do think the reason the case was important is that this is the first religious display case to come up since John Roberts became the Chief Justice. It's the first one in 5 years. And as I say, I think Kennedy has written an opinion that will have an effect on allowing or telling judges to generally uphold these religious displays on public land.
Will they then have to say that it's okay to have a Buddhist symbol too, for example, as the Park Service official that you mentioned wanted to have?
Good question. I don't know, Warren. I would assume the answer is yes. I mean, it seems to me if you're going to allow one religious symbol and say, yes, that's okay, pretty hard to argue that, then you're getting in a different territory if you say we only want one religious symbol, not others.
So you could say if the Buddhists had a symbol that they wanted to put in place that honored, if not war dead, then somebody else for some reason or other, you could say that wasn't just strictly religious.
Yes, it is the case. These cases are always difficult because everybody says the context counts. You know, I think most people would agree that if you had an old county courthouse and you found down on the lower level a mural that has a dusty, if you look real closely, you could say, oh, that's Moses holding the Ten Commandments. most people would say, oh, you don't need to tear down that wall, or, you know, because it's a religious display. If some city puts up a cross on the city hall and says, this is a Christian city, or this is a Southern Baptist city, I think even most conservatives would say, no, that goes too far. But then there's this whole range of cases in the middle where it's the Ten Commandments sitting among a number of monuments on public on a public, you know, state capitol grounds or something. Does that go too far? And so context counts. I just think in this opinion, Kennedy is sort of signaling to a whole lot of lower courts is that you ought to be much more accepting. He calls it,
okay,
we ought to have a policy of accommodation for the future.
David Savage, reporter for the Los Angeles Times, covering the Supreme Court. Thank you very much for being with us, as always.
Thank you, Warren.
Today's program produced by Andrea Brody, with Daryl Satzman and Francis Anderton, our technical director Mike Newport, managing producer Carolyn Radziner. Email us. Share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/to the point. Become a fan of To the Point on Facebook. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point from PRI.
PRI, Public Radio International.